You are listening to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and role-playing gamers.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Hello and welcome to another episode of On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly sort of podcast about role-playing and the player who play role-playing games, the players, and also game masters. And also masters of ceremonies. My name is Eran Aviram.
And my name is Uri Lifshitz. Hello!
And today we are talking obfuscating mechanics. The times where you, as a GM, hide some part of the mechanic from the players. Both Uri and I have very different takes on this. I think that it is a tool to be used on certain occasions, while Uri thinks it is a tool to be used on different occasions. So, what do we mean by this, and how do we actually use this? Uri, please do take us on.
Well, as Eran mentioned, in today's episode, we will talk about two very different aspects of information management. Eran will discuss elements in the game and how hiding them from the players create different effects. Well, I'm gonna actually talk about the mechanics of the game, about the actual rules and what we do with them. Because here's a shocker, I have some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that most gaming systems have some really iffy bits that somehow manage to get past the playtest phase. Or maybe they're amazing mechanics and they're just not that suited to your game, which makes them suck. The good news are that you don't have to use those mechanics if they're not right for you. There are several ways in which you can deal with this issue. Number one is take that mechanic, which does nothing good for your game, and toss it out the window. Defenestrate it. You don't need that kind of negativity in your game. In most of my games, I take whatever is the downtime mechanic and I remove it completely. From my experience, most of them are either rubbish or simply take a lot of time for something that could be resolved while keeping the player's attention. This could be anywhere from managing your castle, going shopping, your characters drinking at the pub, whatever. For me, most of the downtime mechanics are a useless piece of the system, and I usually just remove them, skip over that. I'm sure if you would think about your games, you can find a lot of mechanics that you simply don't use or don't want to use. In some D&D games, you don't have sorcerers, or you didn't have psionics when they were a thing. Or are they a thing? Are they coming back now? There was something about that. So you can simply take that mechanic and get rid of it, and then you're happy. However, sometimes you don't want to get rid of that mechanic. But then again, you don't want your players to suffer. And here's something I do often. I simply obfuscate that mechanic from my players. My best example would be D&D 3rd edition with the grappling rules. I know that a lot of the people who play that simply remove grappling from the game because every time someone would try to do a grapple, the game would stop for 15 to 45 minutes while everyone consult the books and try to understand how grapple works. I simply said, no, I'm gonna take 3 weeks alone in a secluded monastery, study the grappling rules. I would create this large tome of grappling, which I will bring with me to my game. It would require 2 laptops to run, because it's so goddamn complicated. And whenever we have a grappling situation, I would tell the players, okay, give me 40 seconds. I would crunch the calculation, and then I would say, fine, you grappled them, or fine, you didn't. So my players had no idea that the grappling rules are as complicated as they were. It was completely obfuscated for them. But you don't always have to do something this drastic. In some of my games, if I'm running a high-paced game with a lot of action, and I don't want to break the action of the enemy side in order for the PCs to roll saves, I sometimes roll the save for the characters. So I, as a GM, won't have to say, that evil wizard raises his hands into the sky and a black lightning bolt falls upon you, engulfing you in the flames of Hazador as you crumble to dust. Please do a will save and let's see how you're doing with that. 17, you remember the plus one? Okay, that is fine. And then you die! I'm trying to skip over this whole let's roll a save thing and get right to the interesting description. So I would roll the save myself so I could do the whole description and give my player that sense of something happened rather than that play-by-play that breaks the tension. But rejoice, for there are other options. One option is to use a simplified version of that specific mechanic or rule set. Some examples which did really well are things like passive perception. In the past, whenever there was any need for a perception check, everyone would roll. And nowadays, we have the passive perception, which is an awesome way of simplifying the endless rolling of dice in order to see who notices what. The same goes for the set amount of damage rule. Instead of me as a GM rolling to hit and then rolling damage, I can roll to hit and assign the default amount of damage, the average amount of damage, so we're not breaking game balance issues. One could even argue that most of the changes in Pathfinder 1st Edition from D&D 3.5 were simply that, a simplified, more streamlined version of the rules. When I moved from D&D 3.5 to Pathfinder, I allowed my players to grapple again, to disarm, to do all those combat maneuvers which were now easier because we are now playing with a simplified version of those rules. My fourth method of dealing with mechanics that I don't want to have present in my game is to simply homebrew them into something else, something that would work for me. I had a campaign in which I wanted to introduce not insanity rules, but some chaotic use of mental powers. And there was a mechanic for that, but it didn't really fit. It was overly complicated, but I didn't want to give up on that. And I couldn't simplify the existing rules enough for them to actually still impact the game in a meaningful way. So I simply homebrew my own mechanic for this issue, which was based on the original rules, but in a very different way. I think today is some sort of a really miraculous wonderland because you can pretty much go online for any gaming system and look up a homebrew version for any mechanics. And sometimes they would be really on the nose to what you're trying to achieve in your game. Now, these were all ways in which I dealt with problematic mechanics in my games. And I do want to focus on the obfuscation for a moment, because that is what we're trying to do. And I think where I came across this ability to be most useful was in convention games. Now, most of the convention games which I ran were one of two kinds. It was either an intro to a gaming system or a story which I wanted to run, a specific adventure. Now, when I run an introduction to a specific system, I try to obfuscate as little as possible because one of the points of an introduction game is for people to get to know the mechanics, to get to know the specific game. Having said that, if I want to run an intro game and show what a system can do in its high levels, it could be a bit problematic for new players to grasp the more complicated mechanics which some game system offers. This happened to me in Exalted, for example, in which you try to show people what Exalted character can aspire to and develop into, but then the system gets really problematic for new players. So you try to obfuscate some of them and simply give a list of options for players to perform. While when I'm running a story-oriented adventure in a convention, I would sometimes obfuscate entire sections of the rules. And if I have a player who is not that familiar with the gaming system or played years ago and don't remember things quite well, I would simply say, okay, just tell me what you want to do and I will handle all the mechanics, all the side. You don't need to worry about that. That is obfuscated for you. And I think that balance between giving the players the full visibility to the mechanic of a game and obfuscating some of that in order to either handle pacing or simply the flow of the game with players who are not that proficient in the mechanic, is a very interesting balance that we have to constantly maintain, both as GMs and as players who maybe don't want to handle specific mechanics in our characters. And maybe we just never thought about, okay, just moving that responsibility over to maybe another player, maybe an app, maybe the GM. So consider obfuscating some of the rules for your players, or as player, suggest that some of the nitty-gritty bookkeeping details might be transferred to someone else if you're not enjoying them.
Okay, my take on this is a bit different. It comes from a different direction, I think. First of all, the word obfuscation is a bit hard for me to say, so I would say obscuring instead. Obscuring works for me. And it, however, I maintain the same basic concept of keeping the exact details of the rules from the players. That's what I would like to focus on. And I see two reasons to do this, for clarity or for tension. When you obscure for clarity, you are trying to reduce cognitive overload on the players. And that's exactly what Uri said regarding one-shots and convention games. There's no time. We want to keep the pacing. We want to make sure that we manage to go through every bit of the story that we want to go through. And that means that some part of the rules either should be dropped completely or probably obscured and pushed over directly to the GM side, where they will take care of everything and the players will just run through the story. Maybe not everything, but a lot of the things. This is especially useful if it is selective, because some players would come to your table expecting to be able to use every tiny bit, little bit of the mechanic, because that's what they like about the game that you're running, while others will not care and are here for the story. So being selective and allowing some players to use the full ability and others doing it for them, it can be quite useful, and I've been doing it in many, many of my convention games. But I've also done it in my home games. There are rules for sailing in 50 Fathoms. There are. I'm sure there are. There must be, because it's a pirate game. 50 Fathoms is a Savage World setting in which everyone is a pirate. And, well, not necessarily. But it is a pirate world with lots and lots of ships. And there are rules for sailing. There must be. The players are aware of it. They know that in order to sail, you need to roll boating. The captain must roll boating. They're not completely clear on anything else. What happens if they succeed? What happens if they fail? What happens if they succeed with a raise? Is it good? Bad? Do we manage to sail more? How does the crew affect this? I explained everything to them on the first few times we did this. They had access to this information, and I made sure that they are aware of every tiny bit of it. It's not complicated. It just has several details, and because it doesn't happen a lot, I mean, you know, it happens, but once you get somewhere, you will probably stay there for a session or two. And this is important, none of them was the captain. The captain was an NPC. So they didn't really care about the exact details. So I kept them. I kept them for myself. And we managed to keep everything clear for them when they just pointed at where they want to go. And they were generally aware that increasing the boating of the captain is useful. So they helped her as much as they can. It was good. It worked for us. The other role of obscuring is obscuring for tension. And that's very, very common when a GM just doesn't say how many hit points an enemy has or what their AC is. Again, it can be the same in every system in Savage Worlds. I don't tell what their toughness is like. In City of Mist, I don't show what sort of spectrums they have and how many tiers they can take. However, many GMs, I think, take this for granted and assume that this is just a thing that is done. Maybe even a rule of the game. But it usually isn't. Usually it's a convention. It's something that we are used to doing. It's something that we take for granted because we take it for granted because this is how it's always been done. And I would like to shine a light on it and unobscure how to obscure for tension, because I think this might be taken too far in some cases. A few days ago, I posted a question in the D&D 5 forum on Facebook. You know, the one where they have about 100,000 people. And I wanted to switch around the saving format of D&D 5. I wanted to go back to how they did it in D&D 4, where instead of the target, the victim, rolling save, it is the attacker that rolls an attack against their save, exactly like with armor class. How you attack an armor class, you roll, you add your attack bonus, and you compare it to a number. That's how D&D 4 did it for everything. And for several reasons, we'll not get into them, we wanted to do the same thing to help our players get into the mood. We didn't really like how a victim might be able to escape a spell with the player having no way to affect this, because the roll is in the hand of the target, and that was annoying. So I asked, and the main answer that I got was that this will reveal the abilities of the enemy, that this will reveal their AC and their other DCs, and now when I attack, I will know what their saves are like, and therefore I will be losing something, they claimed. They were very much against this, because the general consensus there was this information should be left out of players' hands. It should be hard for them, maybe impossible, to discover what are the details, the mechanical details, the numbers of their enemy. And I think that this is taking things too far. You can obscure for tension, you definitely should obscure for tension, but after the third round, everything should be clear. That's my take on this. If after three rounds, they haven't managed to get the general idea, okay, they have a high AC, I rolled and rolled and rolled, 15 didn't get it, 16 didn't get it, their AC must be really high. Or, I rolled and rolled and rolled, we got it every time, even with a 12, their AC must be really low. If after three rounds, the players don't have the general idea of the AC is high, the AC is low, well, maybe, I don't know what happened in your game, but my point is, it doesn't really matter at that point if it's 16 or 18, so you might as well just tell them. It will make everything easier and quicker. They know it's high. There's no more tension there. The tension is now back where it should be with the die, when you roll the die and you're not sure if you'll get 18. However, rolling the die and then adding some numbers up and then telling the GM, who then needs to check in their notes, that is like several steps too many if it compared to rolling the die and seeing immediately if you passed 18 or not. And that makes everything so much quicker. So by third round, really there's no good reason to keep things hidden from the players. And I would claim this for hit points as well. Once you've dealt 11 hit points three times in a row, and they're still on, and you as the GM, again, robbing something from D&D 4, the bloodied condition, which means this enemy has lost half of their hit points. If you as a GM are aware of the bloodied condition in your mind, not as a mechanical thing, but as a descriptive thing, that is, until an enemy is bloodied, they are generally okay, and once they are past their 50% hit points, describe them as being hurt. And if this is something that you keep consistently doing, so the players are always aware of this, at some point, namely when they are bloodied, there's really no point of obscuring how many hit points they have, and it will make things easier and quicker for everyone if you just know exactly how much hit points you're dealing and if that will be enough or not. That's not completely true, and sometimes it should be hidden, like when you're fighting giant bosses and the like. But generally speaking, for that goblin, they should know the goblins have 15 hit points. All goblins have 15 hit points. Not the first time you fight goblins. By the fourth time you fight goblins, they should know goblins have 15 hit points. But I want to take it even a step further and talk about the DC of, for example, traps. A player is playing a rogue, and that rogue searched for traps, and they found a trap, and it's a marvelous piece of awesome, horrible trap that will kill anyone that goes through the door. If they made the check, but unfortunately, D&D only gives us binary succeeded or failed. So let's go to Pathfinder 2nd edition, where if you succeed, you might critically succeed if it's by 10 or more above the DC that you needed. So let's say that you just succeeded, you might know that the trap is hard to disable. But if you critically succeed, you should probably know it's 25. This is good information. Obscuring this information from the players it's not unfair, but a really good success should provide a lot of information, and there's no information as useful as mechanical information, because that's the rules. You can't go against them. If you as a GM says this trap needs a DC 25 to disarm, this is now the fact, and if the players manage to get 25, then you have to say the trap is disarmed, and which is why this is the most useful bit of information. The trap is very, very hard to disarm is not good, because very, very hard depends on the situation and can be a thousand different things. But I would take this again one step further and say, maybe just say 25. Maybe no matter how good the rogue player rolled, tell them it's 25. If your players are mechanically inclined, telling them the DC to dismantle this trap is 25 can make them go, ooh. It can create tension. If the players are mechanically inclined and they read the world in, well, they don't read it only in the language of rules, but they do know the language of rules and know it well, rules can create tension. Giving the details can create tension. This dragon has 300 hit points is a bit of information that would make me as a player reconsider if I want to attack this dragon. It's an important detail, and it can be useful.
It would make you consider all the choices you have made in your life that led you to play with this dungeon master.
I want to give two more interesting examples from two different games. One is City of Mist, which I should always preface. I am the editor for this game. In City of Mist, all statuses are open, and they're open knowledge. So when an enemy, they are called danger in that game. When any danger gets any status, and status is a good thing, it's a bad thing, it's some sort of thing that affects them. It can be injury, it can be that they are convinced by you, whatever. When they get a status, the status is in the open. It's placed on the table and everyone can see it. So everyone is always aware of what is affecting whom. However, danger profiles are generally speaking hidden until revealed by play. So, if they have a custom move, and most dangers have two or three custom moves, which are moves, that is, special mechanical abilities that only this danger has, they are only revealed once they are triggered. However, the moment they are triggered, they are placed on the table, and from that moment on, the exact wording of them are known for everyone and can be used by the players. So, for example, I give a very simple case of when I attack a rock monster and I inflict an injury of crashed 3, which is a type of status, the GM can then reveal the custom move. Any crashing injury against this danger is reduced by 1. And from now on, I know I should probably not try to inflict crashing injuries on it, because that's completely clear now. These are the rules that are here on the table. This is great because it keeps the tension. You never know which custom moves the enemy has until they are revealed. And just like when we said before about the AC and hit point, etc., once it is revealed, everything is now quicker and moves on forward and still affects the game. I am no longer unsure how to attack this creature, because now I know I should not use crashing. There's some tension is now gone. However, it did its part. I was unsure before. I did a thing. I was surprised. I now learned something new. I now feel more confident in my abilities. Let's continue. And attention moves somewhere else. Tension shouldn't be kept forever. It should be at some point triggered and used. This is the point. this is now. This is when it happened with this specific thing. And the tension is still there because I never know what other custom moves the enemy has. And also, because of the way that these sort of games work, I never know which move the MC decides to use. And they can use any move from the entire repertoire of abilities in the game for any danger, because that's how Powered by the Apocalypse games work. And the second thing I want to talk about is What a Lovely Afternoon. And it's a bit of anti-obscuration. Once we played Warhammer Fantasy 3rd Edition, and it's a game with a lot of fiddly bits, a lot of mechanics, and one of the adventures that we played had a scale called What a Lovely Afternoon. It was player-made, by the way. It was created by some player somewhere, or some GM somewhere, and somehow got to me. And thank you, mysterious GM, for creating this. It's a ladder. It's like 7 steps, and it's placed in the middle of the table. And there's a marker that shows us where we are on What a Lovely Afternoon. This is simply a measure of how well things are going for the guests at a garden party.
Hmm.
And this can be obscured. For example, we can play several scenes where the players go around the garden party and have fun with the guests and try to protect them from attacking Skaven and all sorts of poison and magic and all sorts of crazy things that are happening behind the scenes. And the players never know exactly what is going on until eventually they have in their mind some sort of a generic scale of how well we did. And at the end of the garden party, I tell them what happens. Or we can place this leather exactly at the square center of the table and let them see exactly how they affect things.
That's a really, really interesting mechanic.
The thing I like best about it is there were 2 steps on it, on step 5 and or step 7, that were marked. They had a different color, so the players knew that something happens when you get to 5 and when you get to 7, but they were unsure what. And that's important. That's where the tension was. They knew exactly how close they are to 5 and to 7. They knew how their successes and failures will affect it. They knew, using the rules of that specific system, that if they get several more successes, because you can get many successes, then the chances of increasing, of going up a step, are greater. But they didn't know what would happen when a thing was triggered. That was so good, we are still talking about it to this day, because it made things very clear and the tension very out in the open. And ever since then, I've been a great supporter of mechanizing the abstract and putting it in front of the players. This is not something to be obscured. I think that my summary from all of this is, consider what do you want to obscure from the players. Think about it. Don't take it for granted that details that only you have should remain in your hands. No. Some things might be better for the game if everyone is completely aware of them. And then the tension is, what happens then? Uri, how would you summarize this?
Well, Eran, one of the best parenting advice I got before my kid was born was to listen to everyone's advice about parenting, but remember that 24 hours after your kid has been born, you know them better than anyone, and you know what they need. And I mean by that, that you, the people in the gaming group, know your game and your group and what you enjoy better than anyone. Certainly better than the people who wrote the system or the module or us. And if one thing is really problematic in your game, well, adjust accordingly. There are many ways of doing this. And this doesn't mean that you should alter game systems lightly. Game designers work really hard on creating games to give a certain feel, to give a certain experience, to have balance. Having said all that, you still know your party. You still know what you enjoy. So while I don't suggest changing game mechanics lightly, I do suggest changing game mechanics if they are a problem. game mechanic should be the driving force that moves you toward your goal. And if it's not doing that or doing that badly, then change whatever is not working.
And now I do believe, let me check the time. Yes, it's time to take the load off.
This world is carried on the shoulders of dwarves.
Uri, what have you been doing with yourself in these semi-quarantine times, as long as it relates to role-playing games?
Wow, I've actually had quite a busy 2 weeks. I've changed my war priest into a cleric because apparently war priests are silly in my Pathfinder game. But the more interesting things are, first, I ran a few playtests for the new adventure I'm working on, Star-Crossed Curses, which is an alternate version of Romeo and Juliet played in D&D 5th edition. And I really enjoyed the feedback. I had amazing feedback both on what worked, what didn't work, what was more interesting, what was less. It's amazing how much every single playtest can give you in terms of understanding what works and what doesn't. It's like we always say, you can plan all you want, but no adventures survive an encounter with the players. So get as many encounters as you can to see what works and what doesn't. And I'm also getting ready for a new campaign. I've finished my Masks campaign, and we're going to continue on to be brave and attempt a D&D 5th edition game, which would be the first time for, I think, more than half the party playing Dungeons & Dragons, which I'm really interested to see how people who have mainly played collaborative storytelling games would fare in a D&D 5th edition game. My evil mad scientist senses are tingling with seeing how these players would interact with this system.
Okay, good. Good that you have things to say, because I have very little things to say. I keep playing in a Roll20 game 2 hours per week. We're playing the Forge of Fury, and nothing must change on that front. It's great fun, but really I have so little to say about it. I'm looking forward to it every week, but I have nothing interesting to say about it. The only thing I can tell is that I'm working on a new version of my previously less good game, Menagerie of the Void, which is a single-player storytelling game that is now in its like third iteration or something. You can download the previous iteration if you want to. I opened an itch.io account profile. I won't give you the details because I don't really recommend downloading that until I have the new version, which I'm very happy to say it looks so much better. We should probably do an episode or sometime about single player games. I think that they are, the more I research the topic, the more I go deeper and deeper into it, looking into ways of making both this game and the next game I would like to work on, my Stardew Valley tabletop role-playing game, Earthdrop Mountain, the more I realize how interesting this world is. It's much more than a choose-your-own-adventure type of game. There are journaling games. There are things like my random event creators, engines like my Menagerie of the Void. And there are things that I think we can say about them that will interest role players in general.
I was just about to ask if when you say one-player game, you mean just one player?
Yes.
Like choose your own adventure or one GM, one player?
No, I mean a single-player game. Just one person playing it. I'm thinking of maybe doing Earthdrop Mountain, a one-on-one game, but that is like a whole other shitload of problems going right into your face. There's a track of shitload problem. Put backing into you and then putting it all on your face. So we'll have to wait and see about that. But not for long. Or maybe we do, I don't know. The only way to know is to tune in again next time, which might be probably in 2 weeks. But because you're subscribed to our RSS feed, it doesn't matter. It will just arrive at your podcatcher whenever it is released.
Magically.
Amazing. But until then...
להתראות!
is shared under Creative Commons by attribution and non-commercial 4. Intro and outro are by the Cliché Dio. And you can email us at show@dwarfcast.net.
On the shoulders of dwarves.
To tune in a band.
To tune in again. I'm a bard, I'm a bard. I can tell you all apart. Where are the party? Oh shit, fuck.